You're listening to The Director's Box, a football business podcast. Here are your hosts, Raphael Geller and Jesse Forstott.
Hey everyone, I'm Raphael Geller and I'm here with Jesse. And today on The Director's Box, we're going to be talking with former US national team defender and ESPN pundit, Yanis Mihailuk. Today we'll be discussing a few different topics. The history and transformation of different leagues in American soccer when it comes to attendance and finances. We'll also be discussing why did Major League Soccer stick around when so many other leagues folded, and what was the vision that MLS had that allowed it to survive and thrive for decades. Finally, we'll be discussing with Yanis why he believes in the future of American soccer and discuss the financial strengths and grassroots support for lower division American soccer.
For those who don't know, Yanis Mihailuk began his playing career in the 1980s playing in several professional soccer leagues in the United States. He was drafted by the Columbus Crew in the inaugural MLS draft. Yanis made 44 appearances for the United States men's national team. In 2009, he was inducted into the New England Soccer Hall of Fame. Yanis now works as a TV commentator and studio analyst for ESPN. Personally, he's one of my favorite pundits, especially when it comes to analyzing football leagues all over the world. We think Yanis has some great insight, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Thank you so much for joining us, Yanis. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Raphael. How are you?
I'm doing okay. It's a crazy time we live in, but we can at least talk about football, even if we can't watch it.
Yeah. A little bit of a break. It doesn't hurt, but I mean, it's getting too long now, you know, cabin fever. It's funny how much we miss it and we take it for granted, right? Because I remember before that, not long, having just these loose conversations, talking about, my God, I have no life. You know, I have to watch 5, 6, 7 leagues, and on any given weekend, you know, you wake up in the morning here in the United States, you have the Premier League, the Bundesliga, they all overlap, Serie A later on, and then, you know, when the MLS season kicks in, all of a sudden you realize, well, wait a second here, you know, the games at 5, 6, and 7 at night, and then the West Coast games kick in, and really, it's, you know, it becomes a little bit of a rat race, doesn't it? Which I think we're paid to do. We love it, but there comes a time, I remember a lot of times, it's like, you know, I don't remember last time I had a free weekend, and here we are, no football whatsoever. So at first I kind of, well, I mean, not the disease, of course, but I embraced the fact that I didn't have to watch football all the time, but now I'm getting itchy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie, I've watched a little Belarus Premier League, but that's just me. Today we want to focus on the history of football in the U.S. and talk about the growth and development that football has made on all fronts, financially and, of course, football-wise. And we couldn't think of someone better to walk us through the eras of football in America. Now, I wanted to begin by getting your thoughts on the leagues you played in before MLS, and that's the Major Indoor Soccer League, AISA, the A-League, APSL, and so on. Why do you think all those leagues didn't succeed, or why was there always a need for a new league to be formed?
Well, because there was no real master plan or blueprint in terms of the business of football, right? I mean, everybody thought that was, but it really wasn't. You know, when I look back on some of these things and look how many leagues, but not just leagues, but teams folded, is that it almost seemed to me that, you know, the leagues themselves, the organizers, you know, not so much commission, but you know what I mean, when you put it together, instead of really trying to let the leagues grow organically, you know, when they were looking for investors, they were looking for somebody that had the money and buy the team. The problem was that at that time, those investors were, you know, it almost seems like a lot of them anyway were coaxed into being investors. They didn't know anything about football. They didn't know how it ran. They were probably made promises and kind of, you know, I don't want to say sold bill of goods, but, you know, I do think that you have to understand every investment you make, be it football or anything, any walk of life, right? I mean, if you're going to commit a large amount of money of your own, you'd like to think that you have some understanding where you're putting your money. It's a little bit like a stock market, right? I mean, if you don't know anything about it, but somebody gives you a hot tip, you know, some people will just go blindly into it and then they wonder later why the investment didn't pay off, right? I mean, you have to know what you're buying is the bottom line. I think in those years, I remember some of the teams and owners, you know, they simply didn't know what they were getting into. And as we all know, investing in football is not cheap. And it's you know, and every year there's more demand, and of course the you know, the managers and everybody else demand better players, more money being spent. And we see this today, even though football is a much better place, I think, in general, than it was back then for soccer in the United States. So, you know, I've been part of teams where, you know, I remember playing in AISA for Louisville Thunder, which, by the way, we had a very good team at that time, winning the national title. And pretty much right after it, the team folded. The owners pulled out because they just figured that this is too much money for them. They didn't have that sort of money to lose every season. They were rich people, but there's rich and there's rich. And nobody likes to lose money. Some may be able to lose large amount of money and still be okay. But then there were others back then that just said, this is just crazy. I love it. I mean, those owners, you know, learned to love the team, the players, the coaches, the staff, everybody else involved, but they just couldn't sustain the losses. And I think that that was the case for many, many years and continue until recently. And, you know, you could still make a case that it's happening if you look at in USL and some of the relocations and you know, everything else. So I think that was part of my early career here in the United States, that these leagues just were, they weren't ready for it. The true blueprint and long-term vision was never there.
That's interesting you mentioned that. I want to go back to the times before you started playing, in the times of the original NASL in the 70s when the Cosmos were such a big club in the world. I know you weren't playing then, but do you think the popularity then and everything that happened in that era with those great Cosmos teams was Pelé? Was that the first time Americans were energized about soccer? What happened between that time and when you started playing?
Well, sure, NASL is very close to my heart because my dad came here to play towards the end, well, very end of the heyday. Still played against Pelé and all those guys, but, you know, I think he came here for 75, 76. You know, the league was kind of slowing down. But, yeah, I think this was obviously the first time on a big scale that, that soccer made it here. You know, well, I don't want to speak before NASL because I wasn't born, but I can't imagine there was a league anywhere close to have this sort of excitement and interest, right? And part of that, as we know back then as well, I mean, America wasn't ready for soccer even back then. What made it is the stars, because this is what America is, right? It's about entertainment. Bring the big names and people will pay attention. It doesn't matter if they're true fans of the game, right? The real fans back then, of course, because if you look at America, it's a melting pot, right? I mean, there's always the Poles, the Italians, you know, everybody. So when they saw the Beckenbauers, the Cruyffs, the Georgie Bests, the Eusebios and Pelés and Johan Cruyffs coming in here, you could understand without knowing much about the game that this was always going to be success, because you're selling to the, let's say, non-soccer people, the casual viewer, you selling them the Michael Jordans of the world, right? Or at the time, Larry Bird and Magic Johnsons, right? If you go out there, and this is what NASL did a very good job of, right? They brought the best, the names that I've just mentioned. And if you're a casual viewer, you know, so wait a second. I mean, I've heard of Pelé. You know, they've heard of a couple of those names. So I think that's why it was successful. But again, I mean, it was very, very costly, as we all knew, to bring the best of the best here. And it lasted for a while. But I think, again, it was sort of, you know, and I don't want to speak to that because I don't remember those years very, you know, I was still in Europe, actually, when my father played here. But I've been part of NASL since, right? The second rebirth, if you will, if you remember a few years back. And again, it's I think, in order for this to be successful, you have to have common plan and blueprint for not just when things are going well, but what happens when they don't, right? You have to build that infrastructure, built in risk. You know, this situation that we're in right now is something new, right? But you will have probably some teams that survive, not just because they're rich, or mainly probably because of it, but there are plans, right? If you look at Major League Soccer, in a way now, you know, everybody around the world is making fun of Major League Soccer, right? For being a closed system, for not having promotion and relegation, for this, that, or the other. And some of it is legitimate, I think. But in a way, I can tell you this, and I've been saying this for a long time, and I kind of been laughed at. To a large degree, I can understand. Take away the promotion and relegation, because I'm still a fan of it, if you will. I don't know if it'll ever happen here in this country, but this is neither here nor there. What I do like about this system is that you have a league that has obviously a lot of rich owners that not only reap the benefits, but they share the risk. So in a situation like this that you couldn't foresee with the COVID-19, I think the you know, the league is in a better position than many other leagues. I don't know if you guys agree about you know, on that. This is going places, I promise you. So so I look at the league and I look at the European leagues, and I, you know, they may have to be looking across the, you know, the pond all of a sudden and say, you know what, this closed system, maybe culturally, obviously it's not something that we know, maybe we like, maybe that not something that our fans will like, but I can see, you know, as I said, learning from this, and just even without this COVID-19, I'm looking at this and saying to myself, if I'm in Europe, if I'm an owner, and saying, that's good, why don't we bring, for example, salary cap, right? I mean, you can still, players are still rich, if you look at the American sports here, right? So you can talk about salary cap, you can talk about maybe owners kind of bending together in a way. It's maybe not the best for players in some, on some levels. But, you know, going back to what I was saying, I think NASL ultimately didn't have that plan, you know, because those that knock the MLS system, for a lot of right reasons, by the way, I'm not here to defend it in any way. Matter of fact, when I came to this conclusion, I gave you these examples, I'm kind of just, you know, I was surprised myself. So, you know, there are some parts of this system that works for sustainability, something that NASL didn't have because some of the richer owners just went over their head. They saw some of the success the league was having, right? You know, the 77,000 people, you know, the giant stadium, this, that, or the other. But over the course of the years, they weren't ready for the down cycle. And as we all know, down cycle exists in all walks of life. And when it comes, you have to have an answer. You have to have a solution rather than just quit. I think that's what happens with a lot of the leagues in my lifetime in the United States, the early leagues, that once the excitement, not the excitement, but the entertainment left, they were just kind of, it's almost as if, hey, we had our time, let's move on. You know, maybe the soccer culture wasn't here yet.
It's really fascinating for me, Janus, to hear about what the conditions were like surrounding the pre-MLS leagues that you were a part of, even if, unfortunately, maybe the soccer culture, like you said, hadn't quite arrived. Now, if we fast forward, Janus, and we zoom out to look at the world football stage in 2020, where do you see the MLS fitting into everything, whether that be in terms of the football or in terms of the business that MLS does?
We're talking about the business structure, right, a lot, which is, I appreciate that because, you know, I mean, that's sometimes during when the leagues are playing, we don't have time for it. We just talk about the results, the quality of the teams, of the players, right? But in terms of a business, I will give you this. Because of what we just said about MLS system and everything that we see going on right now, right? And we see teams struggling. We see leagues struggling. We see Bundesliga, where there's problems at Schalke. We've seen in Belgium, Lokeren just shut the door, although they had problems ahead of this. You know, it wasn't just because of it. But, you know, we've seen, I think, in Slovenia. I think we're going to see a lot of teams struggle, right? And maybe some won't survive. We see Ligue 1 when the PSG owners came out and said, this is devastating, even for us, and we have crazy money. We're going to lose a lot of money. We can sustain it, but he wasn't sure, right? Talking about the Ligue 1 was good. So I will tell you this, when it comes to, because I think our conversation here, you have to look at leagues as a whole. If I think of a Major League Soccer, and if you ask me, just as you did, where they stand in terms of just pure quality, I don't know where that spot is, but certainly it isn't amongst the top five, right? That we see in Europe. And where you want to put them there, it doesn't really matter to me. I'm not in this game. I think Major League Soccer is doing okay. It's growing. It's still not where it needs to be. But as I said, it's 25 years right now. I was in 96, the pioneer, I suppose, you know, the original when it started. And if you ask me then if the league was going to be around, you know, 25 years from now, I'd say you're crazy, right? And here we are. So I think it's doing okay, but I'm not going to put a number where United States sits, other than the fact that, you know, if you just look at the quality of football, it's not top five. However, right. I look at teams and leagues in particular, as we've just said, in the light of what's happening, as more than just the quality. You look at Major League Soccer in terms of organization, in terms of taking care of their players, in terms of the risk, everything that's happening, right? When a player comes in here, there isn't a time, I don't think, even at its worst when Tampa Bay mutiny, there isn't a time or a chance the player will not get paid, right? When he's missing his paycheck. It just won't happen. If the team can't play, well, the league is there, right? Because the league really pays the players, don't they? If you look at the whole league, there is no doubt in my mind that Major League Soccer, as an organization, how it's organized, how everything's structured, is top five in the world, no doubt.
No, that's very interesting, and I think you're right. I think we're seeing all over the world that teams are really going to struggle financially. You mentioned a couple of examples. There are also a few in my part of the world with Mediterranean teams in Cyprus, Greece, or Israel that are telling their players, look, if you don't take a pay cut, we just simply aren't going to pay you. It's not even that they don't want to pay the owner. It's that they will not have the money to do it.
It's important to add that so far, Major League Soccer players didn't take a pay cut. But as you know, because we're talking about this now, and 2 weeks from now may be different. So Major League Soccer did go to the Players Association to ask them for a pay cut, right? The Players Union is very, very strong here. I don't know where it's going to happen. And they may have to do it, but this is totally different. That wasn't my point, because this is a situation unlike any other. I'm talking about situations where even in the top leagues, forget this part, players get their paychecks, but late very often. And you know what I mean? So in some of the, good leagues. So that's happening even now. I'm talking about situation in Major League Soccer. Then, remember Chivas USA or like, let's say, Tampa, those players still got paid. The teams might got moved or are no longer here, but players will be covered in that. So I don't know what's going to happen here in Major League Soccer. Maybe the players will have to take a pay cut, but that's different than, I think, a normal situation.
Okay, before you got to the Crew, let's quickly go back to the times that you played in all of those leagues. I think it'd be really interesting to know, what were the salaries in those leagues? Were they similar to the USL salaries now?
The first one was MISL, and that was just great. I mean, that was legit. This was like NASL in the old days, right? I mean, I had no idea about it. I came here in 84 and right away, made my way to Cleveland Force, which was, here we were, Cleveland Force, major indoor soccer league. I walk in, and in Cleveland, there's 20,000 people at just about every game, sold out. I mean, tremendous. And, the Baltimore Blast and San Diego Soccers, I mean, great players there who obviously played in NASL, but because NASL folded, we're talking about all of them playing indoor soccer. And you know how it is. It's like NHL or NBA. I mean, the introduction, Darth Vader was our mascot, and Star Wars was the theme. And when you were getting introduced to the players, lights are out and the music's going. And not only that, I tell this story frequently, but at the time, Cleveland Browns, who played in the Richfield Coliseum where we played, were asking us for tickets. If they had 5,000 people at their game, they were lucky. This is NBA Cleveland, not Cleveland Browns, Cleveland Cavaliers. My apologies, that was football. Cleveland Cavaliers would play there. I remember a player because of his name is stuck in my mind. He was a point guard. His name was World Be Free. He changed his name before. I mean, he was a great, a very good point guard, small player for a basketball player. And, they were asking us for tickets all the time.
But if the attendance was so good, why did the league struggle to gain momentum?
Well, again, after a time, because all teams are, first of all, I think at that time, I was young, I was 17, 18 years old, and I was still getting my paperwork. I was, as soon as I got there, I had tore my ligaments in my knee. So I didn't speak English when I got to Cleveland. So, but I knew the players were making a lot of money. When I say a lot of money, I don't know for sure, but I mean, we're talking at that time for indoor league, many players, probably half a million, maybe more players than 300, so imagine. So I think, we may have 18,000 in San Diego, Baltimore Blast had great, but like Wichita Wings, which was a very good team, a smaller arena. Again, I think it was just one of those where I think a little bit of mismanagement, and people were not ready for maybe a season where a couple of stars leave, you have a couple bad results, and all of a sudden that for the casual people that just picked up on it because it was entertaining, it was fast, it was indoor, it was like hockey. When the results weren't going, the moment the attendance goes down in a couple places, the owners once again kind of didn't have the nerve, because I still think they didn't have the nerve because they truly, they were investors, but they didn't love it. Do you know what I mean? I always think that there's got to be some of it where you're vested in it more.
Are you saying that they weren't maybe passionate about the football?
Yes, and I think a lot of people in that weren't. You know what I mean? Like the players were, the coaching staff was, but maybe people in the, you know, in the offices and all of that, right? They just thought that this gravy train, I think, when it was good, it was always going to be there. It was going to be even getting bigger, right? Where there's always a time in any business, any league, where the gravy train kind of leaves the station.
It's very interesting that you say that, because when I was doing the research for this show, I noticed that when the MLS first existed, it was bleeding hundreds of millions of dollars in the first few years. But even though that happened, there was still the enthusiasm and desire to continue and grow the league.
Because you have passion. You look at Phil Anschutz, who saved the league, right? I mean, remember that time when Tampa left and, you know, it started with 10 teams, then it was 12, whatever it was, and those teams were struggling. I mean, you can look at it in the history. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but Phil Anschutz was just passionate. He loved the game. Till this day, he does. Mm-hmm. You know, he had three or four teams that, you know, eventually he sold off, you know, most of the teams. I think now he only owns the LA Galaxy, right? But look at the commitment he's made over the years. You know, there's a passion to him. I never had a chance to speak with him about this personally, but look at his passion. I mean, if you think of Phil Anschutz, I mean, not just saving the league, and those other Robert Kraft and a couple other owners, the Hunts, obviously, right, who had the Dallas, Mr. Hunt was owner of my Columbus Crew. And there he was, you know, I mean, billionaire, the Kansas City Chiefs, and, you know, now they're in Dallas, and they had Dallas, you know, FC Dallas and all that, but his sons, but he was there in the office working. I was amazed, because I just thought that he was going to be another absentee owner. But other than Anschutz, the Hunts, just unbelievable. I remember the first year in Columbus where he was in the office talking to everybody, and we were like, you know, we were thinking of him as the Kansas City Chief owner. That's what we knew.
But you're saying he had the passion for football in America and also believed in the potential for growth of the sport of football in the United States?
There's zero doubt. I mean, you know, his sons do it seems the same degree. They do it a little bit differently, but they're still in the game. And I just thought that in the first year of this Major League Soccer for Mr. Hunt to be in the offices, to be so hands-on, from my experience from other leagues, you know, I saw that as refreshing. And that's why Columbus Crew, you know, at the time was just, you know, in the new city was strong, because he wanted to make it strong. And he was in Kansas City as well. And then we know, obviously, he was multiple owners. So I think the Major League Soccer had early on and continue to have some owners that are very, very passionate about it. Time will tell with some of the new ownerships, right? But going back to Mr. Anschutz and his commitment and his passion, you know, forget the fact that he owned multiple teams and he saved the league at one point, right? But think of it, you know, his investments with David Beckham, with Zlatan Ibrahimovic, you know, even when they left, you think, oh, Galaxy, now they're done, right? But look at now, even, you know, getting more and more players and you know, Chicharito now, of course. His love for the game or his support for the game continues, doesn't it? 25 years later. Leagues that I've played before, there wasn't many owners like that. You know what I mean? There was one or two maybe that really wanted to desperately keep the leagues going. They were committed. There were two or three owners in the leagues that failed that I've played that were there, but the rest wasn't there. The infrastructure wasn't there.
Right. So you were a U.S. national team veteran. They approached you about MLS and you had played in multiple leagues at this point, and we didn't even have time to mention them all. What were your initial thoughts when you heard, okay, the MLS is coming? Did you feel at the beginning, before you experienced everything you just said to us, did you feel it would be the same as the previous?
I had a hunch because at first I had a little bit of a doubt, because if you remember, you know, the 1994 World Cup was the catalyst, wasn't it? Because it also made a lot of money, and a lot of that money was put towards creating the league, because it was obvious that the league needed to keep the momentum from such a successful World Cup, where every game was sold out and these massive stadiums, right? I mean, it made more money than any previous World Cup, and even made more money than some of the World Cups that happened subsequently, right? Who knows? I don't know where it stands, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's still the most successful World Cup or close to it, right? You guys may do research. But anyway, it was obvious that this was the time to start the league. If it wasn't done then it would never happen. We would not be probably talking about this in Major League Soccer, right? But if you remember, that was supposed to start in 95, right after the World Cup. It didn't. It got pushed to 96, which gave us a little bit of a doubt, right? Because I kind of said, well, here we go again, right? You know, because I, not that I was cynical, but it was just that I've been part of the AISA, the MISL, the APSL, the A-Leagues, and all of that, right? But fortunately, that wasn't the case. And when I did see, you know, the first season, the 10 teams, yeah, it was just 10 teams, but everything was done professionally. I mean, everything, as I mentioned, owner was hands-on, you know, even though at the time we didn't have our own stadiums and maybe training facility, that came in like in the second year or third, but you could see the wheels were in motion, not to cut corners. That's how I would put it. Because every other leagues that I've played in, with the exception of maybe MISL, because it didn't, when I came into to it, it was still well organized, but every other leagues, you had that everywhere. You had that feeling where corners were being cut. I didn't feel that with Major League Soccer, that any corners were caught. The contracts, although at the time were massive, but they were okay. The health insurance was there, right? And the, you know, in the past, no league had offered me health insurance. Hmm. You know what I mean? Here, right away, it wasn't even a question, right? I mean, just the little things, the way you saw the setup, the, you know, I'm trying to think of other examples, but it was just professionally done. You know, when you came to the dressing room, the training gear was there, everything was done properly. And you saw the games being on TV. And when we traveled well. It wasn't, you know, like in the past where, you know, it was a beat up bus and one of them things, right? You know, we're flying everywhere. They weren't trying to say, well, you know what? Let's drive here because it's a short distance. You know, sometimes we make that choice, right? Because it was close enough, but everything was done properly. No, we weren't flying the first class, but we didn't expect that. But you know, we did fly a day, sometimes 2 days before, stayed in proper hotels. Just like I said, and it wasn't that immediately you see that they're trying, you know, the league was trying to be cheap on something. With the exception, of course, of the salaries to with some players. But, you know, it was the first year, so you say to yourself, hopefully there's better future ahead.
Okay, and we've kind of gone through the leagues, and we're approaching 25 years soon. You look at some of the examples with a team like FC Cincinnati. They're now in the top five of MLS attendance. They were a USL championship a few years ago. Obviously, for those who don't know, that means a club in the second division of U.S. football structure. They made the transition from having 25,000 fans in the second tier to now having 25,000 plus fans in the MLS. Can you explain to someone not from America how that's possible? Obviously, not all of our listeners are going to know exactly where Cincinnati is. Not to be rude to Cincinnati, but it's not one of the most famous cities in the U.S. How did this city and how did this club develop such a passion? It doesn't even need to be specifically about Cincinnati, but to me, explains the story of American football when you look at this team and the city and see what they did in such a short period.
Well, there's many examples, right? Atlanta's another one, and I'll get to that in a second because I have experience there. Look, yeah, it doesn't seem organic, but what I think of that is that they, like me, like everything I've said here before, is that they see a vision. Do you know what I mean? Like, they see that this is a legitimate thing, so they want to get behind it. Because, you know, I've been asked the same question about Atlanta. I mean, just the year before I think they started playing, or maybe it was 2 years before, I mean, if you remember, the NASL was reborn, and I was part of the New York Cosmos in terms of their commentary team. JP Della Camera and I were commenting New York Cosmos. And Atlanta had their team, Silverbacks. You know, Eric Winalda, one of my teammates, was involved. It was a good team. Actually, the final was in Atlanta against New York Cosmos. Atlanta was 1-0 in a very small stadium, barely 3,000 people or 4,000. I don't know how many were there. Actually, a lot of Cosmos fans, right? And if you look at Atlanta Silverbacks, they had everything in place. They're a very good team, obviously. Made it to the final. Could have won it in that final, by the way. Cosmos did. But it was a very even game, well-coached, well-organized. But you know, during the season, you watch the, you know, 1,000 people, 2,000. Here's a team in the final. Team folds basically or stops playing because the new Atlanta team in MLS is coming, I think, because or There may have been other reasons, I don't know, but and next thing you know, they have 60,000-70,000 people, right? I mean, average 45,000-50,000, I don't know where, but I mean, a lot of people. What happened? Why didn't they support the Silverbacks, right? Well, I think it's because people see through that vision. People see it. I mean, it's not that they didn't like the team, you know, the NASL team at the time, right? But just they saw it. It was kind of minor league effort to a degree, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you go to that stadium. It's, you know, it was a nice stadium, but, you know, 2,000-3,000 people, you know, smaller name, no big, super big names that they would know, right? And here you are, having seen everything already in Major League Soccer, right? Because you have history of 20-some years. They see the owners of Atlanta Falcons investing in this. They see this brand new, unbelievable Mercedes-Benz Stadium. And you say to yourself, you know what? And right away, the indication from the owner is, in that case, I'm talking about Atlanta, indication is, look, we're bringing Joseph Martinez, we're bringing Almiron, good names, right? I think people see that. People see that there's a platform there, that there's organization there. And in terms of Cincinnati, it's the same thing. Maybe they didn't see the big names come in, and here we are. You know, some owners now can do more than others, but within limits, right? And Cincinnati, like others, have said, well, we're not ready yet from the beginning to invest the sort of money that Atlanta United, or now we see LAFC right away, how they invested. So I think that's what happened in Cincinnati, because I think soccer is pretty popular no matter where you go. And if you show that your product from the beginning is a serious thing, you see a commitment from the owners, and that commitment is obvious, right? Because they have to put in $200 million now. And right away, they're saying to themselves, we're building a new stadium and all of that. I think that excites the base, the one that loves the game, and maybe also, you know, excites the casual fans who may want to be part of history, who may want to have that first season ticket, who may have been, I don't want to say coerced, but maybe they've been talked to by their soccer fans to say, you know what, this is going to be a cool thing, you know. And it's not maybe done in an organic way like in Europe, where you kind of support the team from where you live, but you know what I mean, for years and years and years. But you have to build that culture. I mean, you know, it's 25 years, maybe 25, 50 years from now, it's going to be that organic way where, you know what, my dad supported this team, my grandfather, you know, that's history, right? That's how you build history. You know, that's why I want to say, yeah, it doesn't seem organic. Again, I'm not here to defend. This is the nicest I've been to Major League Soccer, I think, in a long time. I mean, well, not that I go out of my way not to be nice, but I do understand that there's still, by the way, for those that listen to it, there's still many shortcomings and still many things to do to make this league better. There's no doubt. It's not like this all rosy, but I do think this organization, the way it's presented, it shows that there's a very good structure to go long term. We've seen that now for 25 years, and I think we'll continue to see that. I hope we'll continue to see that while also being open-minded to tweak things to make things better. That's what I hope for the future, because if the league doesn't evolve, then okay, maybe this league is going to have a longer run than any other, but it could fail as well, because we know our history here.
Yeah, and I think, you know what you said, having a vision is very important. And you see throughout the world in some countries where football is starting to become more popular. I do a lot of work in the India Super League, and they have a vision, and things have been very exciting there, and the growth of football there has been absolutely tremendous. And it really has to do with the vision of the people who started to do it.
And we talked, guys, about what the 1994 World Cup did for starting Major League Soccer, for kickstarting it, that fed into the type of vision you guys are talking about that kept the league going, fed into passion, grassroots movements, and things like that. Yanuz, what do you think the 2026 World Cup, being joint hosted by the United States and Mexico, what do you think that will do for soccer in the United States?
There's no limits. I mean, you see what's happening right now. I mean, something that I, you know, again, a lot of us in the game kind of felt it for years. You see what's happening in Mexico, right? I mean, they suspended promotion and relegation for 5 years. Who knows if that's ever going to come back after 5 years as well. Obviously, there's going to be a windfall of money. which I think most of it and should be used for, you know, with U.S. Soccer Federation in terms of the development of young players. But as we all know, it'll trickle down to USL, MLS, the women's game, of course, as well, right? But yeah, you can see competitions already between Mexican teams and the MLS teams. There's talk about Super League. There's been talk in some corners of combining the leagues. Who knows? I mean, nothing is impossible. I think it's a strong region. I think it's good to see that Canada is part of that, because I see Canada being part of the World Cup as what I saw in 94 in the World Cup, right? That may be the catalyst for them as well. They've already started their own league, CPL, still small steps, right? Just like MLS was, maybe even lesser. But I think it's good for the region. I've always said that for CONCACAF as a region, it's good for everybody to get better. The better the competition, the better the national teams will be, right? So this is all positive. I think that you will see, it's obvious that Mexico or Liga MX and MLS will try to do something more. What more that is, I don't know. But obviously, if you look at the dynamics and demographics of the United States, it benefits everybody, right, in terms of the Latino population here. So I think I will look towards that in a big collaboration, because yes, Major League Soccer is going to have to become more organic. There's zero doubt about that, because when you look at where the money's being made for Major League Soccer, it's clear that it's the franchise fees, right? And it's already at 250-300. And you know, how many teams can you possibly have? You're already at a limit, just about, right? There'll be 30 plus pretty soon. And when you look at the television deal, it's not where it needs to be for the money to be made, for real money, right? The sponsorship is there, but I still don't think it's massive amounts where the owners in Major League Soccer could say we're making the money that I think we should be making, right? Because if you look at the new owners right now, say you have to put in $300 million just to be able to have a team. Now you're also being asked that you're not going to be let in the league if you don't have a stadium. How much is that? Let's say that's another $500 million to make that to build that stadium, right? So you're out $1 billion before you're out of, if you're an individual owner that comes into the league right now, you're out $1 billion before you even kick a ball. That doesn't include the staff, the players, and anything else. So it seems to me that is unsustainable.
But do you believe that the owners must think that the amount of money they're putting in now, that 10, 15, 20 years down the road, the value of the team and what they could sell it for would be an amount where they can make a profit on, right?
Maybe if they see that in the future there's money for the new owner that they're going to be selling it to benefit, right? And I think what they see, of course, is that, and they hope because they see it, that the popularity of the game is here to stay and get even bigger, right? They see this. They see also, you know, they obviously like the fact that it's a system where, you know, where kind of the league, everybody decides on what happens in the league. And I also think that they see the World Cup as another windfall, which I think, as I've mentioned, MLS somehow will benefit. I don't know how that's going to be. It's either financially or it's going to be the strength of popularity of the game, right? Because the World Cup, once again, is going to re-energize the people that maybe once were, you know, inside. You know, I'm talking about the casual fans that maybe they, you know, there's a lot of people out there that need that extra boost, right? So I think they see the World Cup on the horizon. They see the possibilities that North America has together with Canada and Liga MX. So when you put it together and you put a plan in your head and you say, you know what, strength in numbers, and you see the collaboration with Mexico that was impossible just a few years ago, right? You can clearly sense that there is a collaboration there. You know, I think this is what the present owners, the ones that are coming in, maybe they see a great future there. And as I said, you know, you look at USL, you look at number of teams there as well. I've often said that it's the promotion relegation, it's a difficult one because obviously these owners You know, we all know the reasons, right? I mean, if you invest that sort of money, you don't want to be relegated. You know, but I do see that somewhere down in the future, there's going to be some form of promotion relegation. I do think that it's going to happen. I don't have an answer for how it will happen, but the league can't just grow to 50 teams and all that. It's going to be important to bring new owners who are going to be willing to spend the money to invest in the league. And there's going to have to be a mechanism where, you know, maybe it's not a massive drop-off between one league and the other in terms of money, right? I mean, you can possibly, you know, build the leagues if Mexico is somehow involved and USL. When you look at that, I think there's a way to have promotion relegation and the competitiveness that everybody craves that comes with that, right? Because you have something to lose.
I want to end with this. You brought this up. The USL, it's getting lots of recognition, and you have guys like Landon Donovan becoming coaches and Tim Howard becoming sporting director. And you know, right now, according to reports, you have to pay between 10 to 12 million to join the league. And many cities are excited about that. There are 35 teams currently in the US second division. You've been involved in the USL. You know about these leagues. You've also played in the former version of the USL. How impressed are you with the financial growth of the USL?
Yeah, that's the real story, isn't it? When you stop, but we've talked about 43 minutes or whatever it is, and I've talked about this all the time, and it just kind of dawned on me now that the real story is really the smaller leagues right now. Because when you think about it, in the past, the smaller leagues would not survive because there wouldn't be interest. But there is an interest. So that part is organic, isn't it? There's a lot of fans in the small cities that support their teams. They know they may never get to Major League Soccer, and they don't care. They just love the game. That thought just came to me right now. It's not something, you know, a lot of the stuff I've said already before on different platforms, and you know we sometimes have to repeat ourselves, but now it seems to me that this is the real story. This should be the biggest thing that anyone that listens to it gets out of this conversation, is that, you know, we've said it, that sometimes it's not done organically, but that's the organic growth of the US soccer. Because you can go to Chattanooga, you can go any places where you think this would be the last place that soccer could
Albuquerque, New Mexico is another good example, where New Mexico United play. They're drawing 10,000-11,000 fans per match. That's not a place that you might
right could thrive. Because in the past, the conversation between owners of all the leagues were like, let's put the teams in the biggest cities, right? No, we can go to a small city. We can go to Kalamazoo. It's never gonna survive. Well, look at USL, as you mentioned. Forget the fact that the owners have to pay the money. They always had to. But look at the fans. They're buying into us. They do it organically. They know it's not the best league in this country. They know that they're not going to get the best talent. They know they're going to get the local college guys that finish with the game, but they're embracing that. Who knows? Maybe they're embracing a local college hero who they used to watch in high school, right? Who went on to have a college career somewhere else, I don't know, some other state. And now he's back because maybe that player at the moment is not quite good enough to be Major League Soccer. But you know what? He's one of theirs. It's sort of right, like, right. You know, it's sort of like, you know, the reason I look at this as organic, it's sort of like in Europe, right? I mean, where you know, you can be in London and, you know, there's a million teams in London alone, right? But people at Millwall or, I don't know, somewhere will go to watch their local kid play. And so we're seeing that in these cities that are so small that have never been associated with a city that could ever embrace soccer because they grew up on baseball, football, and basketball. And all of a sudden you have these great attendances and people show up every weekend. So I think that's the success in general. And you got to give credit to USL. I mean, look, it's still in a large way built on the franchise fee, isn't it? I mean, remember, this was started by, you know, my good friend Francisco Marcos. He used to do that all the time.
Yeah.
I forget what the league was called, but Francisco Marcos used to have like 100 teams before it was USL. I forget what it was called when he was doing it. But he was doing this when I was playing. I mean, there were teams, you know, at the time, a 5,000 team here. There was a team in Connecticut. I remember Connecticut Wolves, who Kurt Onofa, who's now the GM of New England Revolution, his father, his brother started. And you know, there were teams everywhere. And some of them were successful, some weren't. And basically, because maybe they weren't ready yet, 20 years ago, right? But maybe Francisco Marcos in some ways has started that infrastructure that continued to grow. And now we have the USL at its present. That's kind of, doing their own thing, doing it successfully. And the success is seen at the gate.
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it with what you just said. What's become so special about the American soccer landscape now is that you have the MLS for fans who want to buy a ticket to go see someone like Zlatan. He's not here anymore, but someone like Zlatan or your Chicharitos. And then you also have, if you're a fan that just wants to be a part of the community, you can go see Chattanooga FC or Detroit City FC, that are these great grassroots movements. So there's everything for every type of fan. Even USL League 2, that's a non-pro league, they have fans coming out. USL League 1, it's the same with them.
I'm going to use this platform, and this is, I've played in all these leagues. I have a lot of problems, not a lot, but I have issues with Major League Soccer. It's not as rosy as this sounded. I have issues with US Soccer Federation, but I do support them. I came from that system, and I'm a soccer guy. I want everybody to be successful. I want to succeed. I'm not going to be the negative guy and come out all the time saying, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. But there are a lot of things that needs to be fixed. So it's good that USL is succeeding, but I want the NASL to come back, because that's history. That's our history. NASL was the league. I want the NISAs to survive, right? I want them to have the same rights as other leagues do. Let them do it like any business in the country. Allow them to do it. Don't look at it as competition against USL or Major League Soccer. So who cares? Competition makes things better. We all know that, right? Allow them to do what they wanted to do. If they succeed, good. If they fail, that's part of life, right? I mean, so I think it's good what USL is doing. I would support the NISAs of the world, because I know they're kind of trying to, get their feet wet. I think Peter Wilt may have been part of that. And, we saw what he did once at Chicago Fire. That was one of the teams like Cincinnati, right? I mean, first year they came in, won the Major League Soccer and the U.S. Cup. Right. Obviously he knows how to do things, right? And ASL in the future, the New York Cosmos of the world, I would love to have them back, right? But we just have to find a way to not only compete, but cooperate. And I do think that there's got to be a way. I mean, look, Major League strong enough. I mean, Major League Soccer shouldn't and doesn't have to worry about the competition. If they do worry, that means they haven't done something right. So all these leagues can exist, because a lot of these leagues, or a lot of these teams from the past, have history, have great, great history. And, to end this, I will tell you that look at this. People, remember, Seattle Sounders, Portland Timbers, Vancouver Whitecaps, they have history much, much longer than Major League Soccer. I played against them in the A-League. They were in NASL. They're great teams. Some people, not the people that are in the game, but a lot of people were surprised how Seattle came about to have the fans in Vancouver and Portland. They shouldn't be surprised. That's organic history. Those three teams are organic. And I played against them, and they had great crowds. Maybe they didn't have 40, 50, 60, but over the years, they always survived, because it went from, family history, from father to son, and they always loved their teams, no matter where they played and what the league they played. And immediately, I knew right away when they were coming in. I remember having this conversation at ESPN, on radio. I said, I have zero worries about them. They'll come in, and they'll bring their history with them. And, of course, they did.
Well, thank you for bringing in NISA, because they've done an excellent job with Chattanooga FC, Oakland Roots, the Cosmos, Detroit City, especially Oakland Roots. I think they've really, really done a fantastic job from the football side to the branding. But thank you very much for joining us. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did. I think we can all agree the future of soccer in America is very bright. And it's been very fascinating to go through the history and see where we were at the beginning to where we are now, and where we'll be in the future. So thank you again for your time, and we hope you and your family stay safe.